May this flame we light remind us that every one of us can bring the light of love to the world. May this clear flame be a symbol that every heart can burn bright with joy, peace, and harmony. May the wisdom of the ages speak to us through this flame and stay in us. Every one of us can be a blessing to the world. Please rise in body or spirit and join in singing our opening hymn, Morning Has Broken, number 38 in the Gray Hymnal. Welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. At LCUUC, we work to bring a message of hope and grace to an imperfect world. My name is Lois Romikas, and I'm the worship associate for this morning's service. No matter who you are or where you have come from, you are welcome here. We welcome those who have some of the answers, and those who have none of the answers, and those who aren't sure they're asking the right questions at all. As a UUA recognized welcoming congregation, we welcome and affirm all people, regardless of who they love or what pronouns they use. Please join us for refreshments and conversations in our social hall after the service, and while you're there, find out more about our church. We're glad that you have chosen to be here today to celebrate and worship with us.
One of the ways we care for the wider community is by contributing to local food pantries, both financially and through the collection of non-perishable food items, which we donate each month. If you have food items to share, bring them forward now, or ask a child to bring them forward for you. And kids, little and big, come on up. Lois and I are going to tell you a story. Gosh, it's great to see all of you. This is a story about monsters. Mom, There's a monster in my closet, Gordon shouted. His mom came running and turned on the bedroom light. Gordon, there's no monster, she sighed. Now go to sleep and stop worrying. There are no such thing as monsters. But, Mom, I heard it breathing. It sounded horrible. I thought it was going to eat me, Gordon shivered. I don't know what you heard, Gordon, but it wasn't a monster. You were just dreaming. After kissing him on the cheek, she pulled the covers around him, turned off the light, and went back to her bedroom. Gordon lay in bed, listening for sounds. There it went again. He pulled the covers over his head, but the noises wouldn't go away. Remembering what his mom had said, he slipped out of bed and turned on his light. He walked over to his closet and opened it.
Hi. Shh, don't be afraid. I won't hurt you.
Gordon noticed a tear running down its face. Why are you crying?
I'm lost. I hope you don't mind me hiding in your closet, but it's warm in there, and I didn't know where else to go.
Who are you? What are you?
My name is Keelan, and I live in a cave near the lake, and this morning I went for a walk. It was such a pretty day, and the next thing I knew, I was lost. I saw your house and thought I might find someone to help me get home.
But my mom looked in the closet, and she couldn't see you.
Grown-ups can't see me. Only children can. Will you help me get home?
In the morning. I'm not going out tonight. It's freezing out there. Go back to sleep for a while, and I'll help you when the sun's out. Keelan climbed under Gordon's bed and fell asleep. He made all kinds of noises. He snored, moaned, and groaned. But Gordon wasn't afraid anymore. When Gordon woke up the next morning, Keelan was still asleep under the bed. Gordon grabbed hold of one of Keelan's plump toes and pinched it. Time to get up and get you back to your cave. Keelan stood by the window as Gordon opened it wide. Come on, Keelan, let's go. He jumped on the grass and the monster followed. There's the lake. You're nearly home. What side of the lake is your cave on? This is a big lake.
I don't know. I think it's over there at the bottom of the hill, but I'm not sure.
The boy and the monster walked around the whole lake until they finally came to a cave. Is this it?
This is it! It's my cave!
Well, you're safe and sound and back home. I think I'll get back to my house now. Try not to get lost again. Gordon waved goodbye and headed back home. Later that night, as he lay in bed, he heard a noise in his closet. He was about to shout for his mom, but decided to look for himself. There was a monster. It wasn't Keelan, though. Who are you?
I'm Brogan. Keelan told me if I ever got lost to come to your house and you'd help me find my way home. Please help me. I've never been lost before.
Every night from then on, a different monster showed up in Gordon's closet. He didn't shout, he didn't cry, and he didn't call for his mom. When he woke up, he always had to help them get back home. He met orange monsters, black monsters, green monsters, and pink monsters. Soon he knew every monster in the valley. So the next time you think you hear a monster in your closet or under your bed, remember, they might just be lost and need someone to help them find their way home. That's the end of our story. May I have today's lantern bearer? May the light and love of our lantern lead you today and every day. Please help in singing out the children and their teachers. The words are in your order of service. Offering is a part of our worship. It recognizes and celebrates that this is our church, governed by us and supported by us. We say that it is a sacrament of the free church. But we know that the free church is not free. LCUUC requires not only our financial support, but also our time, toil, and talent. Most of us give our pledges directly from our bank accounts to LCUUC on a regular basis. So the baskets may look pretty empty as they go around our sanctuary. This morning, let's use our imaginations to fill these baskets with the gifts that we are making to sustain this congregation. Think of what your weekly gift of money really is. Imagine putting those bills, and you can pick which ones. How many, you know, this many dollars? 50s, 100s? Imagine putting those bills into the basket. And then think of the gift of your efforts and talents. Did you make the coffee, mow the lawn, fix the furnace, attend a committee meeting, greet people as they came in? Put those imagined gifts in the baskets. Take a moment or two when the basket reaches you to put in the gift that you make on a regular basis that makes LCUUC possible. Imagine as those baskets go back that they're getting heavier and heavier. The morning offering will now be given and received. Thank you. thank you for all that you do for this community, your time, toil, talent, and your financial support. One of the reasons that we come together in beloved community is to share our laughter and our tears. And we do this in several ways. Before the service, you're always welcome to come up and light a candle on the candle table. And during the service, we speak aloud, and the worship associate lights the candles for us. So would anyone who has a joy or a concern to share, please raise your hand, and the ushers will bring you a microphone. Please limit it to a few sentences so that everyone who needs to speak has time to share.
I'm Christy. If you could please light a candle for my nephew Isaac. He is recovering from surgery to he had part of his lung removed due to an infection he picked up in Arizona.
My name is Esther. Please light a candle for my sister-in-law, Joyce, who is battling cancer at this time, and she's trying to battle it by way of more of a natural way of beating it. She seems to be feeling better, but she's got a long way to go.
Hi, I'm Barb. Please light a candle of joy and concern. Right now, our world seems to be coming apart. The fabric of our society is being torn and ripped. And it's very disconcerting and sad. But let us not forget, things have happened this way many times before. And sometimes we have to break something to work on making a repair.
Hi, this is Matt. Candle of sadness and relief. This week, Heidi and I had our final hearing for our divorce, so it's final.
This is Rick, a candle of joy. This week I attended a funeral for one of my dearest friends. She was almost 104.
And we light a last candle for those joys and sorrows which we hold deeply, but which have not been named today.
In August, Doug Mutter, in his blog, The Weekly Sift, wrote, "I'm a guy, and I'm voting for Hillary Clinton. Lots of us are. Naturally, I also know men who aren't voting for her. But you know what I haven't heard? Not one of the anti-Clinton men I know personally, not even in that wink and a nod, just between us guys sort of way, says that it's because she's a woman, or that women in general have no business being president. Of course, it's also true that if you go looking for that opinion, you might find it. But still, open misogyny has become a fringe position. So hooray! Sexism is over in American politics, and we can stop talking about it. Well, not exactly. The racism parallel. 8 years ago, after we elected our first black president, a lot of people convinced themselves that racism was over. And if we're talking about the open KKK-style racism, they're almost right. You can still find that if you look, but it's a fringe position. And yet, the last 8 years have been a lesson in how pervasive the more subtle forms of racism are. If few white Americans would admit, even to other whites, that they didn't want a black president, but many, many white people have seemed to hunger for some non-racial reason to dislike or mistrust Barack Obama. And so, based on no credible evidence whatsoever, a large segment of the American public had decided that he really isn't an American, and so isn't eligible to be president at all. Another large segment, with considerable overlap, I imagine, has convinced themselves that Obama's whole religious history is a fraud, that he is secretly a Muslim, and is probably rooting for jihadist terrorists, the same ones that he's been killing with raids and drone strikes. Others look at his family through jauntist eyes. To them, Michelle, a beautiful, elegant woman by any standard, resembles a gorilla. And when Sasha and Malalia wear typical teenage girl clothes, they get admonished to dress like you deserve respect, not a spot at the bar. The luxurious White House lifestyle, never an issue when white families live there, suddenly looks uppity. And the cost of keeping the first family safe on vacations, again, never an issue for the Bushes or Clintons or Reagans, has been a point of resentment. Whenever Obama acts like the President of the United States and accepts the deference that is due his office, like when a Marine holds an umbrella for him, or he puts his feet on a White House desk, it just looks wrong. Sure, white presidents have been doing the same things for decades without irritating anybody. But this is different because, well, it just is. And the aura of respect that has sheltered even our most unpopular presidents from direct abuse in formal settings, that vanished as soon as a black man took control of the White House. Undoubtedly, Joe Wilson was not the first congressman to think that a president had said something dubious in a State of the Union address. But none of the previous doubters had judged it appropriate to yell, "You lie!" Summing up, a lot of Americans might say to President Obama, "I don't hate you because you're black. I hate you because so many of the things you do look wrong to me." But if you step back and look at comparable situations from previous administrations, it's hard to escape the realization that what is really wrong in Obama's actions is that he's black when he does them. Here ends the first reading.
Our meditation this morning will be a sung meditation. Tracy will begin by singing "There Is a Love" and then invite us to join in for several more repetitions. The words are in your order of service. We will close with a few moments of silent meditation for the spirit of prayer. Thank you.
The situations are so familiar that they are pretty much cliches. You stand at the shore with the waves beating out their rhythmic crash and the water rushing almost to your feet, seeing nothing but a thin line of horizon where sea and sky meet. The distances suggest infinity. The ocean's unfathomable depth and power, its ceaseless primordial force and mystery. The air, too, moves in a huge current, and the soaring gulls catch light on the back of their wings. Something within us unlatches and expands in that immensity, catching some hint of our finitude. The oneness of life emerging from sea's embrace eons ago, the sovereign beauty and freedom of so much overwhelming space and light and sound. Perhaps it's you. It is the stars at night, somewhere beyond the reach of our puny, interfering city lights, the whole sky filled with uncountable rays originating from trillions of light years away, planets and galaxies beyond imagining, made of the same stuff we're made of. And you stand amazed in the shower of brilliance. Or perhaps your taste runs to the deep forest, or the towering redwoods, or the stunning ribbons of color in the Grand Canyon, or the suspense and drama of a thunderstorm, or the reflection of a sunset on a hidden lake, or even the first unfolding of green of the garden, coming back to life after winter's severity, or the mystery of a pair of sky blue robin's eggs. Somewhere this planet has a showstopper for you that takes your breath away and makes you tug at other people's sleeves to make them see what you see. The whirling autumn leaves with their wedding song of death and beauty, the heartbreaking call of the loon or the wolf or the whale, the nuzzling of newborn creatures after the labor of birth, or the struggle of the monarch out of the chrysalis into unfamiliar wings. For me, it is waterfalls. I could stand all day, dumbstruck by the vision of such endless abundance, the living energy of creation poured out unceasingly before my eyes, seeming to promise a truth that something in the world and therefore something in me is never and can never be exhausted. It makes me want to weep, want to dance, want to fall on my knees and be one with whatever that is in everlasting praise. Here ends the second reading. Please rise in body or spirit and join in singing Precious Lord, number 199 in the Gray Hymnal.
Thank you.
Every kid knows that there's at least a possibility that there are monsters in the closet. Eventually, that belief fades, although I'm careful to close the closet door at night. Children dwell in a world of experiential truths. Santa Claus and boogeymen are real figures in children's lives until they lose experiential truth value. A while ago, I listened to a 3.5-year-old lecture his older cousins on boogeymen. The 8-year-olds listened patiently, clearly knowing that there weren't such things, but being polite. His 5-year-old cousins, however, were quite willing to argue about the qualities of boogeymen. It doesn't take much to get toddlers believing in Santa Claus or boogeymen. Such figures, imagined but not present, have strong experiential truth value for children. The concept of experiential truth first occurred to me after I heard a paper presented at the American Psychological Association a number of years ago at the convention. In his paper on fairy tales, a valuable methodological resource, James Dillon argued that the vitality of fairy tales for little children gives us a glimpse of the spiritual life of children. According to Dillon, quote, "The child's mind works in a mythical fashion, which is very different from the logical and discursive way that most of our adult minds work, at least when we're awake and sober," end quote. The mythical world is experientially grounded, and the boundaries between self and world are porous. Rabbits can tell us stories. Boogeymen can hide under our bed. In myth, we don't ask, can this possibly be true? If it feels true, it is true. If it feels true, it is true. Myth uses metaphor and symbol to represent the feel of our experience. The validity of myth does not require that it make rational, logical, reasoned sense. Rather, the validity of myth is its ability to resonate with our experience, to speak with experiential truth. As I listened to Dillon, 2 verses from the New Testament popped into my head and took on a new and powerful meaning. Matthew 18, verse 3. "And he said, truly I tell you, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." And Matthew 19, verse 14. Jesus said, "Let the little children come to me. Hinder them not, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these." As a child, I had loved the picture of Jesus surrounded by the little children. It was linked to "Jesus loves me, this I know," with the glue of experiential truth. As I listened to Dillon with my adult mind, I realized that experiential truth is the core of religious belief. Children connect to that core very easily because experiential truth is not readily challenged by rationally or empirically grounded truths in their lives. Indeed, the road to belief in God is paved with experiential truth rather than reasoned or empirical truth assertions. So Jesus' insistence that one must enter the kingdom of God with the mind of a child gains in power when we see that mythical thinking is the foundation for experiential truth. What is this experiential truth? We are sentient beings. Our experience is rich with sensation, touch, hot and cold, bangs and tinkles, nice smells and yucky ones. Ordinarily, the sensations are a background to the flow of events, ideas, objects, and interchanges. Central to that experience is a sense of self, experiencing, thinking, interacting. This self dwells within us, peeks out our eyes, and can be revealed to others or hidden. Our mind is the active agent of self. Self and mind are mythical, at least from a neurological perspective. So powerful is their experiential truth that the idea of a universal mind, a supreme being, supreme self, if you will, makes strong experiential sense. Let me backtrack a bit. Our lived world seems like something we look out on, but it is the product of an amazing information processing apparatus, many aspects of which we share with other creatures. This processor takes input from a variety of sensory surfaces which interface with the outside world. The processor, the brain, combines that input with stored information, including expectations about how the world should be. The product or output is an ongoing flow of lived experience in the world. The task of this processor is to give us a stable, coherent, meaningful world. This is why delusions and hallucinations are so convincing and so disturbing. The process of forming a lived world from sensory input and stored information is silent. We experience the result as what is real, not as a processing product, but as the world out there and us in here. As our cognitive skills mature and we acquire knowledge, the experiential truth value of monsters and Santa Claus and even the Easter Bunny fades. We increasingly depend on rational or reasoned truth and upon empirical truths, those produced by evidence. Still in all, ghosts and demons still have experiential truth value for some of us. And the importance of experiential truth does not fade. The vitality of religious belief and practice depends on experiential truth. If we believe in a deity, that conviction of divine agency must be grounded in experiential truth. If we do not believe in a divine agent, as I do not, the idea and sense of there being a divine agent simply does not have experiential truth value for us, at least most of the time. That is not to say that nothing arouses the sense of the sacred for those of us who are not theists. The chime of the Rin Gong at the beginning of the service is not just a sound. It moves us experientially from profane space into sacred space. The chalice is not just a piece of pottery with a flame, but something that centers us as a religious community. For this service, I chose hymns which evoke a sense of the sacred in me, hoping that they do in you too. I'm pretty sure Blue Boat Home does. Mourning has broken evokes for me a sense of sacred creation. Precious Lord was written by Reverend Thomas A. Dorsey after the deaths of his wife and child in childbirth. It evokes in me a prayer space quite independent of my rational atheism. Without experiential truth, our religious life would be just going through the motions. If and when people realize that that's what it is, they tend to drop out. The vibrancy and zest of life depend on experiential truth. Consider falling in love. It is a sea change in our experience of the beloved. Consider the enchantment of puppies and puppy breath. Consider the beauty and power of art, which lives in the experience of the beholder. Consider the primal reverence described by Dr. Kendall Gibbons in our second reading. But like so much, there is a yin and yang to experiential truth, dark and light, separating and connecting. Our lived experience comes with attached meanings. For example, we attribute danger to snakes and spiders. We attribute attributes to people whom we've never met before or interacted with. Young black men come into our experience loaded with dangerousness. Indeed, bigotry is rooted in experiential truth. If the road to heaven is paved with experiential truth, so is the road to hell. Right after the Republican convention, Doug Mutter, author of today's first reading, wrote a blog that was an excellent case study in the dark side of experiential truth. Mutter pointed out that the beliefs and fears that turn Donald Trump's, quote, collection of cherry-picked statistics and random falsehoods into something that sounds coherent and believable are in the listener. They seem to belong to the speech, but actually are in the listener and are poured into the speech. This is why the so-called dog whistle works. For some listeners, a coded message summons a set of feelings and convictions into the experience of the present moment. In India, Trupti Desai, a woman and devout Hindu, is leading a movement to allow women into the most holy parts of Hindu shrines. Women have been forbidden to worship in these holy areas because they are perceived as unclean. The taint of menstruation is an experiential truth which appears in a number of religious traditions, including Buddhism, Judaism, and Christianity, which are patriarchal in their political structure. And is it too far-fetched to suspect that this experiential repugnance might have a lot to do, or at least something to do, with why there has been so much resistance to women taking leadership roles across religious traditions and in our political life? When Donald Trump needed a heavyweight insult to fling at Megyn Kelly, what did he choose? Blood. It is not only well-intentioned white people committed to the worth and dignity of each and every person who are dismayed to become aware of perceptions loaded with preconception. Experience gave him more grief than hearing footsteps behind him, turning to look and feeling relief because the person following him was white. Young black men come into our experience loaded with dangerousness. From a social psychology perspective, people who know the deck is loaded against them, who are victims of systemic violence, of generations of degradation, who see the doors of opportunity slam shut, people like that, particularly young people, are more dangerous. We see that in the behavior that Donald Trump has enabled, just as we see it in the disturbances following police shootings. Nevertheless, black Americans are 2.5 times more likely to be shot by the police than are white Americans. I think this is because black people, young black males in particular, come into the experience of the police preloaded with more dangerousness than do white people. So, are we trapped by our experiential truths, forever locked into them? We are so blessed by the experiential truths of beauty, belovedness, and holiness. Yet we deplore the ugly associations which creep unbidden into our experience. How can we change an experiential truth that we realize is not true or consistent with our values? Experience. What changes experiential truth is experience. Now, it helps to be aware that our experience is a product of present input and preconception. But in order to change the experiences that emerge from the processing, we need to modify the processor. Children quit believing in monsters as their competence and mastery of the world increases. We engage in spiritual practices to enhance our experience of the sacred. We worship together. We sing our favorite hymns. We read meditation manuals or poetry. We nourish our spiritual lives. If we have the opportunity to interact with people who seem other to us, we should seize it. If we do not, or if that opportunity is limited, reading is a powerful alternative. Read autobiographies and biographies and novels. Reading is an experience generator. We live in the stories we read, and they do change us. The perception of black men as dangerous clearly affects the behavior of the police. If we think of that dangerousness as an experiential truth, it suggests some remedies we could pursue. Experiences with the black community, and particularly black men, could be built into police training to try and modify that experiential truth of dangerousness. As a psychologist, I would think about what we do to try and modify phobias, which by definition are an inaccurate experiential truth. Certainly, it would help if our neighborhoods and our lives were more rich in racial diversity. What does it boil down to? Once we understand that we are participants in our own experience, that our preconceptions shape the way we perceive the world, The way we hear what others say, what we think we see, once we understand that, then we become responsible for our experiential truth. For this is another aspect of the free and responsible search for truth and meaning. I think we have maybe 5 minutes that we could devote to a polylog. I know it's not in your order of service, but we agreed that if there were time, we would do that. If the ushers have microphones, this is, I have the official words I'm supposed to read here. A polylog is a time to share brief thoughts on the sermon or service. It is not intended as a question or answer period, although I do have all the answers. Please limit yourself to a sentence or two so that all who wish may share.
This is Gus. Thank you very much. That was excellent. Edmund Husserl, the phenomenologist, would have loved that talk. I had never been to the Lincoln Memorial before. Last weekend, I went out to Baltimore with a couple of friends, and we went to Washington, D.C., and went up and just sat on the steps as the sun was setting, overlooking the reflecting pool, and the Washington Monument was right there in the Capitol building behind it. And it was so cool to be in the presence of myth, and I'm not using that word disparagingly at all. The monument itself is built as a Greek temple. It's Greek architecture, and it says even inside this temple. Of course, Lincoln was huge, sitting in his chair, and there was such a mix of people there. Sitting on the steps that we did for like 10 minutes or so, I was just looking at all the kids that were there, the racial diversity, the age diversity. There were kids sliding down the side, I don't know what you would call them in architecture, but the marble slides alongside the steps. And their mothers were yelling at them. Their mothers were, trying to keep them under control, but the kids were having a good time. And I just thought, looking at all of these people, if the politicians were there, either candidate, actually, but any other politicians were there, which people would they eliminate as being un-American? And I was just like, it's all of the Congress and the Senate should be taken there to watch this sort of activity taking place. So anyway, that was very experientially moving to me.
This is Dave, and a few things you said there reminded me of the value of what I've heard is a Buddhist philosophy of having a beginner's mind, you know, going back to before we have all these rational things that kind of taint how we see the world and that sort of thing. And then there's also a quote by Pablo Picasso who said, every child is an artist. The problem is how to remain one once you've grown up.
This is Mike. My observation is people are rationalizing, not rational. So they'll make an emotional decision and then come up with rational reasons to justify that emotional decision, and which is kind of a compelling part of the RNC's platform nowadays. I mean, even there was an interview I saw with Newt Gingrich right after the RNC, and stats are that cities are safer, the country is safer, and reporters were bringing that out, and Gingrich was like, doesn't matter, it doesn't feel that way. So the most important thing is, you know, forget the facts, you know, go with your feelings. So that's what the whole platform's about, and that's the appeal of Trump.
Hi, this is Tom. First of all, thank you for such an insightful talk. There were so many things I could possibly think of from it that I don't know where to start, really. But one group, one perception that you didn't mention that I think strongly exemplifies the fear of the unknown is our treatment of Muslims. Most people have had zero interaction on a personal level with people who are Muslim. And I fortunately, during my career, had many opportunities to work with people from Pakistan and Syria and other countries. And it normalizes people. And the experience, as you mentioned, changes your understanding. And I think this just emphasizes the importance of interfaith work.
That's all the comments, then the sermon part is concluded.
We put out the flame, but carry with us the conviction that every one of us can be a blessing to the world. Please rise in body or spirit and join in singing our closing hymn for this week, Blue Boat Home, number 1064 in the Teal Hymnal. We receive fragments of holiness, glimpses of eternity, brief moments of insight. Let us gather them up for the precious gifts that they are.
and renewed by their grace, move boldly into the unknown. Blessed be.